It is just past 8:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I'm Janine Etter. With the upcoming Democratic debates beginning tonight and race being a key focus to be discussed, we recently spoke with acclaimed anti-racist educator and author Tim Wise about many points covered in the 2016 documentary The Great White Hoax that explores Donald Trump's race-baiting 2016 campaign for presidency. We speak about the history of white identity, racism, and the long-standing historical pattern of how racism and racial scapegoating have shaped American politics for centuries. Tim Wise, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about when the concept of whiteness came into being?
Well, you know, whiteness is a pretty recent thing in historical terms. I mean, really, it's a concept that didn't have any meaning in Europe prior to what became the colonial period in what would become the United States. So if you go back and you look at literature in Europe in the 1600s or before, you're just not going to find people of European descent referred to as white people in any consistent way. There might have been references to white as a color of certain people in Shakespearean literature, for instance, but it was almost always it was not meant to sort of create a notion of pan-European identity. It was actually oftentimes to describe people who were ashen and who were sickly. It didn't necessarily indicate anything positive. In the colonies of what became the United States, you begin to see the term used, and you begin to see that in the middle of the latter part of the 17th century. Really, the first time it appears in any kind of law is by the 1680s. And that's right in the wake of a number of rebellions, Bacon's Rebellion in the Virginia colony, as well as others, where you had European indentured servants, low-income, poor, landless peasants, teaming up with, in the case of Bacon's Rebellion, African enslaved folks to overthrow aristocratic economic arrangements in that particular colony. And there was a real fear on the part of landowners and the elite that these rebellions could spread. And so one of the ways you try to, keep that from happening is with divide and conquer tactics, which in this case meant let's create this thing called white. Let's tell these, piss poor peasants who don't have anything that they're on our team, and we're going to create this team. We're going to call it white, even though we can't stand poor people, even though we've essentially enslaved them as indentured servants. We forget all that. We're going to get rid of indentured servitude. We're going to, let them enter into contracts, testify in court. We're going to put them on the slave patrol, keep those black folks in line. So you give these poor people a certain sense of power, not a lot of power by any stretch, but enough to make them feel special. And then you create this, what W.E.B. Du Bois would call the psychological wage of whiteness as a substitute for real wages. So you're still poor. You still don't own anything. You're still suffering and struggling, but at least you're not them. At least you're better off than somebody. And that concept is then fully concretized by the time the country becomes a country. The very first law that is passed after the Constitution is ratified, before they did anything else, they passed the Naturalization Act of 1790, which says all free white persons and only free white persons can be citizens of the United States. So this concept, which at that point only had a century of history, became a cornerstone of the notion of citizenship in America itself. And that concept of whiteness as Americanness has then haunted us ever since the founding, because it was at the heart of, in many ways, the abolitionist struggle and the Civil War. It was in many ways and has been at the height of and at the center of our debates over immigration dating back to the 1880s, certainly by the 1920s when immigration restrictions are passed. So at every turn, right, this notion that America equals white and white equals America, it's not just something that Nazis say. It's not just something Richard Spencer and David Duke say. It is something that the founders actually said in so many words, and which others have been struggling mightily to change and to amend, if you will, ever since. And that has been sort of the foundational struggle of the country.
And so then there's the question of what is racism? Because when we think about racist, again, we think about Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And the neo-Nazis. And even as a recent example, at the House Oversight Committee hearing with Michael Cohen,
yeah,
Mark Meadows,
right,
brought a black woman to show that brought a prop to show that Trump wasn't racist because he hired this staffer, Lynn Patton.
Right.
Yeah, and Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib had to apologize. Well, first she called him out. Then she had to apologize when he said that she was calling him a racist. And so just the whole thing was just...
Well, it was ridiculous on multiple... Yeah, but, but I'm glad you brought it up because it's really a metaphor for the difficulty we have as a country understanding what racism is. First of all, let me explain what was racist about what Mark Meadows did. It wasn't the obvious, like the fact that he brought out his quote unquote black friend or Donald Trump's quote unquote black friend. Yeah, that's racist on multiple levels because we all know that's like the fallback that white folks do when they're accused of racism is talk about their black friend, like somehow that means you can't be racist, which, as I've argued many times, makes no sense. It'd be like heterosexual men saying they can't be sexist because they date women or because they married a woman or because they have sex with women. Like, obviously, straight men can be sexist, even though we are intimate with women, which is a lot deeper, you know, than just being buddies. So it's a stupid argument and it's a racist argument and it has a long history. But what was really racist about what Meadows did and what's frankly racist about Donald Trump hiring her for that position at HUD and Ben Carson, for that matter. Why do you hire two black folks who have no background in the department, in the area of housing? Ben Carson is a brilliant surgeon. He should stick to that. You know, it's like saying, well, he lived in a house once. He can do housing policy. Well, I mean, I've driven on roads, but don't make me the Secretary of Transportation, right? So if you take black folks who actually are not qualified for the position and you put them in charge of it, you have to ask, why would Donald Trump do that? Well, it's because he didn't care about the Department of Housing and Urban Development, because in his mind, what is HUD? HUD is the organization that, in part, along with the Department of Justice, sued him and his daddy in the early 1970s for housing discrimination. So all he thinks of when he thinks of HUD is black folks, low-income housing, anti-discrimination law. So in his mind, he's thinking, oh, let's put some black people in charge of it. You know, let's just have these black folks. And we don't even care if they've got a background in it. We don't care if they've studied it. We don't care if they're experts. What could be more racist than that? Treating HUD as if it's just like this backwater thing. Who cares? That's fundamentally, in my opinion, racist. And then putting black folks who aren't really qualified for it in there just because they like you and they're on your side. And she was, the prop that Meadows brought out, you know, she was a party planner for one of his son's weddings or some nonsense. I mean, you clearly don't take black qualifications seriously. There are plenty of black folks really qualified for that job who he could have tapped. But of course, you know, he doesn't care enough about that department to do so. So that's number one. The bigger point is people like Meadows and others, I think, and Trump's a good example of it as well, will usually think of racism as this thing that is so much about bigotry and hatred that you literally have to hate all black people, for instance, in order to be racist. And if you don't hate all black people, or if you don't think that all black people are inferior, then you can't be a racist. Well, by that standard, David Duke is not a racist, because David Duke will tell you, and he has said this many times, that he knows that there are white people who are less intelligent than some black people, and there are white people who are more criminal and deviant than some black people. But he still says what? He says, in general, white folks are smarter than black folks. Black folks are less intelligent. Black folks are less law-abiding. White folks are more law-abiding. So if I say that in general, this group is superior in some way to this other group, that is like the textbook definition of racism as an ideology. And the fact that I might carve out some exceptions to that doesn't mean that I'm not racist. I mean, Barack Obama is a good example of this. There was polling taken like a month before the 08 election where something like 25-30% of white Democrats said that they still believed at least one negative stereotype about black people to be true, but they still were going to vote for Obama because they liked him. I don't like most of them, but that one's okay. Well, how is that not racist? Of course that's racist. If you think the rule is still negative, the fact that you found an exception that isn't doesn't get you out of the charge. So racism is that. It's also, of course, more than that. So that's racism as an ideology, the belief in superiority or inferiority. But the other level is systemic. It's also about Because it's an ism. This is how we know this. Isms, capitalism, socialism, communism, are isms. So they're not just ideologies, they're systems. And at the level of a system, racism is about a system that is composed of policies, practices, and procedures. Some of them are formal, some of them are informal, that produces inequity between people on the basis of race, or that maintains pre-existing inequity on the basis of race. And so racism doesn't necessarily require overt racists. It doesn't necessarily require overtly hateful or bigoted people.
And so in this modern era, racist language is no longer acceptable. But you talk about in the documentary coded language, like states' rights and busing. Can you talk some more about coded language?
Sure. Well, the piece in the documentary about that is sort of looking at the way prior to Trump, because Trump is a little different in some regards, but prior to Trump, for a period of, you know, 40 years or so, the way that conservatives had learned to talk about race without talking about race, or at least not obviously talking about race, was to use what Ian Haney Lopez calls dog whistle tactics. And that meant, you know, using phrases that everybody understood were really about black and brown folks, and specifically black folks, which would allow you to have some plausible deniability. And so we have in the documentary an audio clip of Lee Atwater, who before Karl Rove was probably the, you know, most prominent Republican campaign strategist in the country's history. He worked on virtually every Republican and conservative campaign in the 80s and the 70s. And Atwater, who famously, you know, worked with Bush, worked with Reagan, there's a tape of him in 1981 admitting very, very clearly what he and others like him had been doing for years. He says, you know, you start off in the 50s, and you can use the N-word. And he doesn't say the N-word. He actually says the word over and over again. I won't say it, obviously. But he says, you know, used to be you could say that word over and over and over. But then it gets you in trouble by the late 60s. And so you can't use that word anymore. You have to say, you have to get abstract and say things like states' rights and busing and taxes. And he says, now at that point, you're getting so abstract that everybody knows that what you're talking about is going to hurt black people, but it doesn't seem like that's what you're talking about. It's just economic policy. It's just other stuff. And of course, you know, Nixon did this with law and order as a phraseology in the 60s, and it was part of that Southern strategy. Reagan certainly did it. The first time that Reagan ran for president in 1976, one of the stories he loved to tell on the campaign trail was about a woman in Chicago. And he never said that she was black, but the fact that he chose Chicago as the inflection point, it was pretty obvious that's what he was trying to get across. There's a woman in Chicago with 80 names and 50 addresses and 137 social security cards who's, you know, gotten $500,000 in welfare, driving her Cadillac to the welfare office. This was all nonsense. There was one woman that had committed about $8,000 worth of welfare fraud, a woman named Linda Taylor, and she had been busted for that in the early 1970s. She was, according to some people, she was black. Other people would say she was mixed race, somewhat racially ambiguous, but regardless, $8,000 in fraud, and she got caught. But Ronald Reagan told the story to make it seem like that was normal, and he knew full well everyone was going to think welfare cheats who are black. He told another story about strapping young bucks, the exact phrase that he used, getting T-bone steaks with food stamps at the supermarket. Now, this story was completely fabricated, but it was intended once again to craft this imagery. Everybody knew what strapping young buck meant, but then he could, of course, try to deny it. Busing was the same way. All these, you know, sort of coded language things that people did for years in order to gain support. Now, Trump is a little bit of a break with that in the sense that, unlike those other candidates who dog whistled in a way that would allow some plausible deniability, Trump just basically said, screw all that. And rather than dog whistling, was using like bullhorns. You know, when you talk about, well, Mexicans, they're rapists, they're criminals, they're drug dealers. Some of them are good people. Like that's a lot more blatant. That's not really dog whistling anymore. Or when you start talking about the need to do stop and frisk in black communities, which he just said blatantly during the campaign, or when you call for the, you know, the execution of the Central Park Five, and then when the evidence says that they're not guilty, you refuse to take back what you said and you continue to stand by your position. That's not even dog whistling. Now it's just out in the open. So the frightening development that I'm trying to trace in the movie and just in general in my work is, you know, for years, politicians have played this race game and used race as a tool, obviously, to manipulate voters. The dangerous thing is, as bad as dog whistling was, we're now at a point, apparently, in America where you don't even have to dog whistle anymore, where you can just get up and say blatantly racist things, and white folks, at least a good chunk, will still say, oh, yeah, okay, we're down with that. Yeah, that sounds about right. You know, 20 years ago, that would have torpedoed your campaign. And so something has happened, and it's not good what's happened. The fact that we're at this place now where you don't even have to front, you know, you don't even have to pretend any longer.
But Ronald Reagan said, let's make America great again in 1984.
Right, he did. He did. And yeah, the MAGA thing is like the closest that Donald Trump comes to dog whistling. Obviously, that's a coded kind of thing. And it does allow some plausible deniability because Trump can say, oh, you know, Trump has never actually been willing to define the period that he's talking about. The one time he tried to answer, I think he did say something about like the Reagan years, which was a pretty smart answer, I guess, on his part, because that's a lot better answer than if you say 1957, right? I mean, obviously. But to say the Reagan years were great, I mean, it's funny. First, Donald Trump used to bash the politics of Reaganomics. So it's funny that he would now think they were great. And during that period, of course, is when we see the war on drugs really take off. It's a period where tax cuts really never did trickle down to the vast majority of Americans. It's a period where the government, you know, just completely turned a blind eye to the HIV/AIDS epidemic because it was only killing, quote unquote, those people. Reagan didn't care until Rock Hudson, his buddy, died. And so it wasn't a great time for LGBTQ folk. It wasn't a great time for black and brown folk. It wasn't a great time for poor folk. You know, it really wasn't a great time for anyone other than perhaps, you know, straight, white, cisgendered male Christians who were riding pretty high during that period. So that's a little bit of a tell. That's a little bit of a dog whistle. But the rest of it is really pretty blatant. And the fact that he's able to be that blatant and still, you know, either get people to deny that it's racism or ignore that it's racism ought to concern folks for sure.
And you answered this somewhat, but I want to ask more specifically, what is the conversation we need to be having around white male violence as a country?
Well, I think we need to think of, first of all, we need to have a more capacious understanding of violence, because right now, when we think of violence, we think of it in this very narrow way. So we think about street crime, for instance. We think about, you know, homicide, and we think about aggravated assault, and we think about robbery, and we think about rape, and those are certainly blatant examples of violence. But we also know that, you know, violence, or if we think of violence as activity that causes physical harm to people, right, then we would need to think of violence in a much broader way. We would want to think of violence as, you know, the effects of toxins in the water in Flint and elsewhere, because that, why is that not violence? Well, just because what they did was, you know, technically legal, and that's even arguable, but the fact that it's not prosecuted as a crime doesn't mean it wasn't violent. The same thing is true with war and militarism. The same thing is true with police misconduct. If you look at all the ways that people can be and are physically harmed by others, there's no question that the vast majority of harm that is done to others is done not by the poor and not by people of color, but done by more affluent and elite white folks. The difference is the things that they do that are harmful to people are either not illegal or they're not prosecuted in the same way. I mean, you can think of, you know, I'll give you an example. If I were to go into a bank and rob the bank with or without a gun, if I just even said I had a gun or just went in and said, hey, give me, you know, $500 or $1,000, and they gave it to me, and, you know, I get arrested, I'm gonna do some pretty significant time in all likelihood, because what I've done is harmful, and it's seen as, you know, societally destructive, and the state prosecutes it. If, on the other hand, I am an employer and I engage in wage theft vis-a-vis my employees, so I, you know, don't pay them for prep work. Let's say I own a restaurant and they come in early and they do prep work and I don't pay them for that, or they do overtime and I rip them off. And the FBI says wage theft costs 3 to 4 times more every year than all the street crime, robbery, theft combined, all the house break-ins, all the bank robbery, all of that combined, everything we think of as robbery and theft combined, wage theft is 3 to 4 times more money. But how many employers are actually prosecuted for wage theft. There are hardly any, if any, right? The best you can do is like get a lawyer and sue the employer. But if you had the money to sue the employer, you wouldn't have been in the, you know, you probably would have left the job in the first place where you were getting screwed over. So you're not going to probably even be able to sue them to hold them accountable. So why is that not violence? If I robbed the bank, that's considered a violent crime, especially if I had a weapon. But if the employer robs me, you know, steals from me, that's not considered misconduct in the same way. It's not considered criminal, certainly not considered violence. So number one, we got to have a broader definition of what violence is. And then secondly, we need to understand that violence has a lot of different motivations. So part of figuring out the difference between, let's say, the violence of the desperate and the poor and the violence of the more privileged and affluent, it's not to say that one is acceptable and one isn't. I happen to think that, you know, violent crime is not acceptable no matter who commits it. But we do need to at least have an understanding of motivation, because I would argue the violent crime of the elite, or not even crime, because again, sometimes it's not criminal, the violent actions of elite people or people with advantages, to me, are more socially problematic because there's a pathology there. There has to be a level of premeditation there. We, you know, if you're desperate and struggling and you walk into a you know, convenience market and hold it up, I mean, I'm not defending that at all, and I don't think that's okay. But there is a difference between that person whose pathological and deviant behavior perhaps could be addressed with better opportunities in a different economic structure and, you know, a society that took seriously the need to make all communities livable, as opposed to someone who is a Wall Street banker who makes six figures, high six figures, maybe seven figures, but feels the need to rig the system even more on their behalf and cheat even more on their behalf. Like these parents that got their kids into colleges they didn't deserve to be in by cheating when the system was already set up for them. It was already set up for them, but that wasn't enough. They had to do even more to rig the system. To me, those people are far more dangerous than the typical person that walks into a liquor store and robs it for $100. That's not to say that the liquor store robber is okay and that that's acceptable, but like really, which of those is more destructive to social cohesion? The person that had everything but for whom everything wasn't enough. To me, that's more problematic, and we need to think of it that way.
Well, Tim Wise, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Tim Wise, author and anti-racist educator, speaking about the documentary The Great White Hoax and race politics in America.
That takes us to 8:30 in the morning. The program's Up Front. My name's Brian Edwards-Tieker.
And I'm Janine Etter.
Coming up after 8:30 news headlines, we're going to do a curtain raiser on the upcoming two nights of Democratic presidential debates. We'll be joined by John Nichols of The Nation. That's next.
After the news.